Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Benjamin Weicker, a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute and at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Dr. Weicker has written several well-received books, including most recently, The 10 Books That Screwed Up the World, The Darwin Myth, and Answering the New Atheism, co-authored with Scott Hahn. We're going inside the pages of Dr. Weicker's book, 10 Books Every Conservative Must Read, plus 4 Not to Miss and 1 Imposter, published by Regan Herring. I am so excited to have you back with us, Dr. Benjamin Weicker, the author of 10 Books Every Conservative Must Read, plus 4 Not to Miss and 1 Imposter. Ben, thanks so much for coming back.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
It is a delight reading every single one of your books. Of course, you know I love the 10 books that screwed up the world and everything else that you've done. But this one, wow, what a great subject. What it inspired you to tackle the conservative mindset?
Well, in a way, it was actually the readers of 10 books that screwed up the world. Because I kept getting this question. You know, people appreciated it. It was very popular. They saw what I was after, the importance of the arguments. But then they said, well, what about the good books? You know, we don't want to live in a screwed up world. We need something to guide us. There must be good books out there. What are they? And so, you know, after thinking about it a while, I chose these books because they're the books that we really should read at this point. That is, it's not the 10 greatest hits of conservative media or, the 10 most popular or my favorite conservative books. It's those 10 books that every conservative must read to really get a kind of positive account of what conservatism means rather than just merely a negative and reactionary account, which is largely what's dominating things out there now.
You bring up a good point. Do we know what true conservatism is? Do we understand the definition of terms?
I think that there's not a good, deep understanding. Everyone's aware now that we've got all kinds of reactions, mm-hmm. a strong conservative upswell, given a lot of the sort of more collectivist things that the current administration is doing. And it's not clear, though, once you get conservatives around the table who are reacting against these things and saying, well, we want smaller government, we want lower taxes. Well, what do you want them for? I mean, what is conservatism for? Does it have a positive account of human beings and the cosmos that allows us to say, this is what a conservative world would look like, and it's a good thing? So what I'm doing is going back through these great classic conservative texts and, first of all, coming up with a deeper understanding of just what it means to be a conservative. And to show people that it's not merely a flash in the pan movement or one tied to a particular administration and power, I go all the way back to Aristotle's in ancient Greece to work with Aristotle's Politics, which sounds like a daunting text, but mm-hmm. it's really Aristotle is the philosopher of common sense, and I'm taking readers through these ideas, and so I use Aristotle's Politics, and I think your audience will be happy to know that I use G.K. Chesterton's Orthodoxy mm-hmm. as another of those texts, and C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man, as well as Eric Voegelin's The New Science of Politics, giving me that positive definition. And what's central to that definition is of conservatism is a kind of reverence and awe toward creation and specifically toward human nature. And that is, in part, a moral reaction, as Chesterton makes so clear. It's that reverence and respect for the glory of human nature that makes us bow before the limits in human nature, intrinsic to human nature, the moral limits, and makes us a moral being under a good and loving God. Whereas, against this, liberalism tends to reject those limits. It tends towards secularism, and it tends towards the notion that natural limits can be overridden by human power, and this can be most effectively done using political power, especially insofar as it's united to technological power, in an effort to create a kind of kingdom of God on earth. And conservatism always worries about playing God precisely for the fact that it also affirms that human beings are sinful. So you, in conservatism, true conservatism, I'm going back to Aristotle, who was a pagan philosopher living before Christ, you still see the outlines of a basics of Christian theology, which Christian theology takes for granted. Human beings are made in the image of God, yet sin has distorted us, and it makes us wary of all grandiose human projects.
We're talking with Dr. Benjamin Weicker, the author of 10 books every conservative must read, plus 4 not to miss and 1 imposter. I just have to say, Ben, that those first 4 books, I think, are so key because you go back to society and the fundamental building block, that of the human person. But also, as you point out, as Aristotle brought forward, even before Catholic social doctrine, the importance of the family.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that I can't trumpet enough, because conservatives tend to always talk about the individual rights and individual this and individual that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the real origin of society, Aristotle argues, and the Catholic Church argues, is the family. The family is that the cell of society. It's the first moral unit. It's where society has its initial form, so that society it depends on it, essentially. So, and it already has moral confines in it. There's a father and a mother, a husband, a wife, a daughter, a son. These things entail kind of moral relationships, economic responsibilities, and they're part of a social organization. All that is inherent in the family, and that gives us our first understanding of what it means to be social, political, economic creatures. So the Catholic Church has always emphasized not the individual, this isolated, abstract, none male, none female, not a father, not a mother, not a son, not a daughter thing, but real human community as it arises naturally and forms the foundation of society. So what we can see in 10 books every conservative must read is an emphasis on those points that are perfectly compatible with Catholic natural law doctrine. Exactly right.
Again, going back to Aristotle as the first book in the whole series of the books, the 10 books that every conservative should read, is that Aristotle brings out the importance of the city. I have to go back to, again, Catholic social doctrine, where we talk about subsidiarity and essentially that Chestertonian thought that big government, big business, big anything is too much. But as Aristotle pointed out, the city, the size of a city, now that's the ideal type of perfect human community.
Exactly. You get a resonation there with a fundamental conservative political principle that society is built from the ground up, and it's got certain natural limits that when you reach them, you've got everything human beings need, and if you go past that, you've gotten too big.
Mm-hmm.
And so Aristotle considered a nation too big to be the central location of our political life, because that would bring about a kind of tyranny of some distant power over local power. And that resonates exactly with the Catholic doctrine of subsidiarity, which I'm hoping, you know, I put it explicitly in here in several chapters,
mm-hmm.
in 10 books every conservative must read, so people can start talking about it. Because that's really what, so you know, you might say the Tea Parties are after, and the principle of subsidiarity is this: that no larger, more general power should ever do what can be done by a more local, less abstract and general power.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an essential principle of Catholic doctrine that's overlooked. It keeps the Catholic Church solidly against notions of strong centralized government running everything, and it's an affirmation of the moral responsibility of individuals in families in local communities to build up their lives. That's their moral part of their moral perfection. Their moral perfection that a centralized government tends to rob them of by taking away their moral, economic, and social responsibilities. So the principle of subsidiarity, you'll find in running through these books, you find it in Aristotle. Of course, you find it in the in the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
But you find it in Aristotle. You find it in Chesterton's Orthodoxy. You find it in Hilaire Belloc's The Servile State. You find it in Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom. But maybe even more importantly for this political climate we're in now is you find it in the anti-federalists. That is, those people in the debates around the ratification of our Constitution, which were opposed to the ratification of the Constitution as such because they believed it gave too much power to the federal government. These were the folks that pushed for the Bill of Rights, and the Bill of Rights wasn't just a list. Oh, you can have guns, you know, and things like that. Mm-hmm. It was actually an affirmation, a bulwark against federal intrusion on local life on the principle of subsidiarity. Local life, township life, state life is the real location of our social political goings-on. For our own health, we don't want that taken over and run by some centralized authority that's distanced from us, that removes our responsibility and distorts what we're trying to accomplish in our attempt to flourish politically. So this Catholic principle of subsidiarity turns out to be a common coin among conservatives, both ancient and modern, and it really needs to be heralded. I'm so glad you picked up on that.
I think that part two, the democracy and the founding of the American regime, the books that are contained in that section are a must read. They're not difficult reads, but they're essential in today's political climate because, again, as you point out, the terms liberal and conservative don't necessarily mean what they meant in the day when they were first brought forward, and it has caused a great deal of confusion. But if you can go back to an Edmund Burke, if you can go back to, well, in particular, to Tocqueville, you'll mm-hmm. understand why America became the country that it is and how we'll lose it if we're not careful of those fundamental principles.
Yeah, and often conservatives look to the Constitution itself as a kind of small document of salvation, and none of these folks would allow that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
For them, the primary focus is always the way of life you're leading.
Mm-hmm.
If you lead a certain way of life, you will walk right into a servitude to a strong centralized government that tyrannizes it. Oh, that tyrannizes you. Okay, it doesn't matter whether you have a written constitution or not. If you yourself aren't constituted, your society isn't constituted for liberty and moral responsibility from the ground up, then you will lose your freedom. No document will save you.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of these folks, just like the Catholic Church, don't look for systems to save you. They don't look for laws to save you. They don't look for abstract principles. They point right to our moral responsibility to live a certain way. And I'll give you an obvious example that for most of us is all too painful at this point. If we hadn't individually, that is as families, run ourselves into debt, bought houses way bigger than we could afford, and then asked the federal government to give us things that we didn't want to pay for through taxes, we would never have had the debt crisis.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't something that somebody did to us. Anyone can see this in looking at the kind of debt carried by everyone, all these families, and the kinds of things that they purchased with it that went far beyond what they could really pay for or were willing to pay for. And so this is the kind of warning that somebody like Edmund Burke would give or Alexis de Tocqueville. You can't live in a way that destroys the moral foundations of your republic.
Mm-hmm.
If you do, again, no written document, no set of laws will save you. And just like this parallel problem, Roe v. Wade is one thing. But even if you change it today, we've become an abortion culture.
Mm-hmm.
We want abortion. You know, it's part of our moral fabric now. It's horrifying. So merely changing the law is not enough. You have to change the characters of the people. So when we lose our character, we lose the characters we had at the beginning, well, then the worst prophecies of someone like Alexis de Tocqueville and his Democracy in America come true. That book, as you note, is just an absolute treasure trove of wisdom about our virtues and our faults and the dangers that are lying there in democracy that can come to fruition. And a lot of his predictions or a lot of his descriptions have become prophecies. So it's kind of hard to read Tocqueville in that respect, but it's our fault. We're the ones that ceded our moral responsibility and frittered away our freedom.
When you destroy that inner foundation, the basic building blocks of any society, of any culture, that being that natural glue of the family, you blow that up, then you've weakened the structure. So when it becomes top heavy, that all of a sudden it just collapses on,
yeah,
because the foundation, it has been weakened.
Exactly. And what you find, and this was indicative of the effect of secular liberalism historically, conservatism begins with the family. Individuals come from the family.
Mm-hmm.
But the family's first. The family is, in a way, more important than the state because it's the moral foundation of it. It's what gives it its determination, what it is. It's the flourishing of human beings who are social, political animals by nature, as seen in the family. Well, what we found in modern liberalism is that the family is being annihilated, and all you have left are individuals and the state. Individuals in the state and nothing in between. And as Hannah Arendt and many others, I'll actually all the way back to Aristotle, argue that when you take out what all those things in between the individual and the state, what are sometimes called intermediate institutions, like the family and the church, mm-hmm, local governments, civic organizations, when you take all those out, you create the condition for tyranny, where there's one thing, there's the state and all the isolated individuals. And you see individuals, even in families today, being isolated. They live in the same house. They all have separate rooms. They're all plugged into different things. That's what a tyrant wants, as Aristotle points out. He wants the maximum disintegration of people so they're isolated from each other, they're easier to control, and they're far more likely to run into the arms of a centralized power for protection and gratification.
And ultimately, that centralized power becomes the power of, essentially compared to the millions or maybe even billions of people, it becomes the handful of human beings who are ultimately have the power. Then
yeah,
it becomes total
it's
tyranny.
It's one of those awful confusions that in a situation like this, it'll be the power of everyone. You know, that was the illusion of Marxism. What's ruled by the people? You know, it's a democratic tyranny or a democratic despotism. Well, it's really not. What happens, and Friedrich Hayek's Road to Serfdom is really good on this.
Mm-hmm.
What actually happens is that the power coalesces among a very small group of technical bureaucratic experts. That is, even in our government, I'm not talking about the Soviet Union, but when the government tries to micromanage all these details, well, it goes beyond even what your representatives in Congress can do, because it's just too complex. It's too difficult to get under intellectual control and even say anything coherent about it for the nightly news. So they got to hand it over to experts and hand it over to people in federal bureaucracies over whom there's no political control, no responsibility. And it's those very few people who will write the regulations which will determine how it is that even the most general laws are going to be imposed. That's what people have to worry about in healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
In this recent, you know, all the brouhaha about healthcare, socialized healthcare centered in the government, it isn't what the healthcare bill said. It's the fact that it's got to be implemented by a small number of techno-bureaucrats who will actually write the regulations that are going to be enforced by law. So yes, we, you know, it's one of the most important things to point to drive home is that the road to collectivism doesn't benefit everyone. It's actually controlled by a very small cadre of people.
You bring out Hilaire Belloc and the servile state, as well as the wonderful book that not very many people have ever heard of by Frederick Is it
Friedrich August von Hayek?
I love it how you say that. The Road to Serfdom. But you don't have Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations when it comes to economics. That might be a surprise to a lot of people.
Although I have in my favor, by the way, that The Road to Serfdom, Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, was been number one on Amazon for like 6 days, and now I think is at number two or three. It's selling more books than any other book in the nation.
Wow!
Over the past week. Of course, the reason is Glenn Beck brought it up, but it's right now an immensely influential book, or stands to be immensely influential, and I think it's much better than Adam Smith. I've always been wary of Adam Smith. His ties to the Radical Enlightenment, to David Hume, have always worried me. And I think that Hayek is just a much more profound economic philosopher. And frankly, The Road to Serfdom is easier to get through, too. And I think it's just a better text.
Again, we're talking with Dr. Benjamin Weicker, the author of 10 books every conservative must read, that it's not just the political, economic, or even the philosophical books that you point out, but you give us great literature to explore as well. And I love The Tempest. It is one of the best and most challenging of Shakespeare's plays.
It is. And it's a glorious play, and people are going to be surprised how conservative Shakespeare is. That is, two of the greatest writers, I would say three of the greatest writers in the English language I include here, specifically William Shakespeare's The Tempest, Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility, and J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings.
I just love Sense and Sensibility.
And that's good, because it is an absolutely wonderful but profound book. You know, I cringe when I hear people characterize Jane Austen as merely a romance writer, and you're thinking, oh my gosh, I mean, where are you? She's one of the great philosophic minds in literature. I mean, she's just extraordinary. Her understanding of human nature and human character and her defense, the Sense and Sensibility is a defense of wisdom against passion, the defense of the family against the romantic individual doing whatever happens to, you know, tickle her emotions. It really plays on this fundamental divide between conservatism and liberalism, which we're dealing with today. And it's just an absolutely wonderful book. And I include the literature specifically because I think all too many conservatives are so worried about economics and politics that they don't understand that conservatism isn't just about economics and politics. In fact, that's a small aspect of it. As Chesterton made clear, it's the conserving of the full, wonderful, buoyant, colorful, explosive, beautiful complexity of human nature, the whole thing. And Eric Voegelin is big on this, too. And our imagination is an essential aspect of that. And as Lewis argued in Abolition of Man, we have to train our imaginations. It's a moral responsibility. So Sense and Sensibility is an extraordinary text. I'm a big Jane Austen fan. Plus, I have five daughters, so that helps, too.
Good for you. But also, we have to mention Tolkien's, of course, Lord of the Rings. I mean, you talk about imagination and setting up a view of the like no other.
He calls it a secondary world. And I give it a, you know, he gives it a very profound treatment in a short essay called Fairy Stories about what he's really up to. And if you want to understand the Lord of the Rings, you've got to get hold of this essay on Fairy Stories because it opens up how extraordinarily profound Tolkien was. You know, this ain't just a book about elves.
Right.
This is a book that takes you to the very core of what's going on, the great cosmic battle that's really going on behind the veil that sort of clouds our understanding. And Tocqueville understood the creation of these secondary worlds to be a way to dislodge us from our sort of ordinary but not very deep living in the world itself. We have to get into a story to be able to look into our world afresh and see what its real and deep moral contours are and theological depth is. And so that's what the Lord of the Rings does. It, through our imagination, it creates a world which, oddly enough, allows us to see our own far more deeply and clearly. So It's an extraordinary work. Happily, there were three extraordinary movies that help us visualize that. Because again, you know, conservatives aren't just brains walking around on feet. It's the whole human being.
Excellent point. It is. I mean, that's the thing that you get in the totality of what you brought to us in the 10 books every conservative must read, plus four not to miss and one imposter. I mean, the totality of the human person and that one imposter book. I mean, Atlas Shrugged.
It is. Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged.
Oh.
Now, that having been said, I do point out here are the good aspects of Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged. So five or six points that even conservatives may have overlooked, that are worth noting. That having been said, there are very dark aspects of Ayn Rand that cannot be overlooked and that put her outside the pale of those who should be held up by conservatives as fundamental and defining.
It's one of those books that you really owe it to yourself to read so you can understand. You have to be able to embrace those kind of books. And I think you did that for us in the 10 books that have screwed up the world. You should read them so you can understand how we get to where we go sometimes.
Absolutely. It's as I have said many times on it, when accused that I was trying to have books burnt, I want these books read. Mm-hmm. If it's in reading these bad books that you get a real understanding, a deep understanding of why we're in the difficult position we're now. And of course, conversely, it's reading the 10 books every conservative must read that allows us to see far more deeply what it takes to climb out of the hole.
Oh, just excellent work. I just wish we had more time, Dr. Benjamin Weicker. Any final thoughts?
Well, I'd be happy for folks to stop by my new website, www.ameaningfulworldradio.com, where I'm starting a new audio program for free downloads where I have interviews, in-depth interviews about just such things. And our first one is, interestingly enough, on Ayn Rand.
Excellent. I'm going to be tuning in.
Yes, and they can also buy 10 books every conservative must read there.
And actually, I would encourage everyone, books that everyone must read are any books by Dr. Benjamin Weicker. Just a joy to have you back, and I hope you're working on more things.
I'm trying to. That in my garden.
Oh, good. How's the menagerie of animals?
They're doing just fine and costing as much as ever.
Okay, great. Dr. Benjamin Weicker, thank you so much.
And thank you.
We've been going inside the pages of Dr. Benjamin Weicker's book, 10 Books Every Conservative Must Read, plus 4 Not to Miss and 1 Imposter. Dr. Weicker's books can be found at www.meaningfulworldradio.com or at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download this discussion along with many others, please visit www.insidethepages.com. I'm Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.